had to have many rapids and some major falls on it as it descended from the Rockies to the Pacific. On October 23rd, the expedition came to the beginning of a spectacular but dangerous stretch of the river that extended some 55 miles. It contained four major barriers, all inundated today by dam reservoirs, beginning with the Celillo, or Great Falls. In one short stretch of violent, roaring cataracts, the river dropped 38 feet through several narrow channels between cliffs as high as 3,000 feet. Today's Deschutes River came into the Columbia from the left just above the falls. At the mouth of the Deschutes, Lewis and Clark went off in different directions to examine the surrounding countryside and study the falls. Clark got to the falls first, Lewis having delayed on his exploration to examine a root, the Wapato, that the natives dug in great quantities in the bottom of the Deschutes. After studying the falls and conferring, the captains decided that only the 20-foot drop had to be portaged. They were able to hire local Indians and their horses to help portage the heavier articles. At other places, they managed to lower the canoes through the rapids using strong ropes of elk skin while packing the baggage on a portage. Indians gathered on the riverbanks to watch the white men. Their presence was often a blessing. They had dogs and dried fish to sell, they provided information on the state of the river downstream, and they had a technology that the captains could use. Lewis visited a village where he had observed his first Chinookan canoe, made of pine, remarkably light, wide in the middle and tapering at each end, with cross pieces at the gunwales that made the craft surprisingly strong, and skillfully carved animal figures on the bow. Clark wrote that, "These canoes are neater made than any I have ever seen and calculated to ride the waves and carry immense burdens." Lewis was able to exchange the expedition's smallest canoe for one of the Indian craft, after he agreed to throw in a hatchet and a few trinkets. As the expedition prepared to make its way through the falls downstream, the captains learned that they would be passing into the country of a people with a different culture and language from any they had previously encountered. They were Chinookan, and the Nez Perce were at war with the Chinooks. On the night of October 23rd, Twisted Hair said he had heard from his relatives among the local Indians that the Chinookan people living farther down the river intended to kill the Americans when they arrived. The captains examined the rifles and made certain every man had 100 rounds of ammunition, but that was a daily routine anyway. Clark commented, "As we are at all times and places on our guard, we are under no greater apprehension than is common." The following day, Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky said they had decided to return home. They explained that the Chinooks would surely kill them if they had a chance. Besides, they could not speak the language, so they could no longer serve as interpreters. The captains persuaded the chiefs to stay with them for 2 more days, until the expedition had gotten below the next falls, which were but 2 miles downstream, to give the captains an opportunity to bring about a peace between the warring nations. The next set of falls, called the Dalles, began with the Short Narrows, a quarter-mile-long stretch in which the river was constricted to a mere 45 yards in width. Clark was appalled by "the horrid appearance of this agitated, gut-swelling water, boiling and whirling in every direction." The captains explored the banks. Agreeing that no portage for the heavy canoes was possible over the rocky ledges, they decided to send by land the men who could not swim, carrying the most valuable articles with them, while they and the swimmers ran the fall in the canoes, bringing the heavy and less valuable baggage with them. In selecting the items to be portaged, the captains showed their priorities. First of all, the journals, field notes, and other papers, including Jefferson's letter of credit to Lewis, which would become invaluable if they chanced to meet a trading ship at the mouth of the Columbia. Second, the rifles and ammunition. This was taking a chance. For the first time, the bulk of the party would be defenseless in the presence of Indians, but that risk was more acceptable than risking the rifles in the falls. Finally, the scientific instruments. By the standards of today's canoeists, this was a Class 5 rapid, meaning it could not be run even in a modern canoe specially designed for whitewater. The natives, expert canoeists themselves, did not believe Lewis and Clark could do it in their big, heavy dugouts. They gathered by the hundreds along the banks to watch the white men drown themselves and to be ready to help themselves to the abandoned equipment afterward. But to the astonishment of the Indians, the Americans made the run without incident. Below the short narrows was a relatively calm 3-mile stretch. Along the bank there was an Indian village of wooden houses, the first wooden homes the captains had seen since they left St. Charles 17 months earlier. There were stacks of dried, pounded fish on scaffolds, at least 5 tons by the captain's estimate. The principal chief from the village below paid a visit, which, in Clark's words, afforded a favorable opportunity of bringing about a peace and good understanding between this chief and his people and the two chiefs, Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky, which we have the satisfaction to say we have accomplished, as we have every reason to believe, and that those two bands of nations are and will be on the most friendly terms with each other. That was wishful thinking, and how the captains could have been so sure of themselves and so satisfied is a mystery. Neither side could understand a word the other side said, and the sign language of the Plains Indians that Driard used was imperfectly understood by the Chinooks. The next river obstacle was the Long Narrows, where the river narrowed to 50 to 100 yards for some 3 miles. As at the Short Narrows, the captains decided to have the non-swimmers portage the most valuable items, while they ran the river in the canoes. Again, Indians gathered on the banks to await the inevitable disaster. Again, the canoes made the passage safely. Below the narrows, where the river widened, the party made camp on a high point of rocks. The captains chose the site because it formed a kind of fortification. Clark explained, "This situation we conceive well calculated for defense." They called it Fort Rock Camp, on the site of today's city named The Dalles, Washington. There they stayed for 3 days to make repairs to the canoes, dry the baggage, and do some hunting. Lewis took the opportunity to make some celestial observations for longitude and compass variation. They had a parting smoke with Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky. The local Indians were proving troublesome because of their proclivity for petty theft. Any object laid aside for a moment vanished. The captain's greatest concern became not the Indians' arrows, but the protection of our stores from theft. It got so bad that the men muttered they were well disposed to kill a few of them. On at least one occasion, the captains had to restrain the men. As Clark pointed out, "It is necessary at this time to treat those people very friendly and ingratiate ourselves with them to ensure us a kind and friendly reception on our return." On the night of October 26, 2 chiefs and 15 men crossed the river in a canoe, bringing presents of deer meat and cakes of bread made of roots. The captains gave medals to the chiefs, trinkets to the men. Private Cruzat brought out his violin. York danced for the Indians, to their delight. The hunters had brought in 5 deer that day, so there was plenty of meat. One of the men gigged a steelhead trout, which he fried in some bear oil given him by one of the Indians. Clark pronounced it, "One of the most delicious fish I have ever tasted." The visiting chiefs spent the night. Altogether, it was a good start for U.S.-Chinookan relations. As always, Lewis took a vocabulary of the Indians, although how he accomplished it without a translator is unclear. On October 30th, the party set out again to a point 2 miles above the last great drop, the Cascades of the Columbia, the great chute to Lewis and Clark, where it made camp in anticipation of a reconnaissance in the morning. Lewis took a party of 5 men to visit a nearby Indian town. Along the way, he shot unsuccessfully at a California condor, which he correctly judged to be the largest bird in North America. At the village, he got a friendly reception. The Indians gave him berries, nuts, and fish to eat. But, he told Clark, he could get nothing from them in the way of information because of the language barrier. The reconnaissance revealed a section of river some 4 miles long filled with rapids passing through a series of chutes and falls, the water passing with great velocity, forming and boiling in a most horrible manner. But beyond the great chute, the river widened and had every appearance of being affected by the tide, which was great news. On November 1st to 2nd, the party made its way through this final barrier. At times, the men had to portage the canoes and the baggage. At other places, it was possible to run the canoes through, using elkskin ropes to lower them. The following day, moving downstream, the party came to Beacon Rock, the beginning of Tidewater. The expedition had entered a much changed world. The banks were covered with fir, spruce, ash, and alder, contrasting sharply with the treeless semi-desert country upstream. Migrating waterfowl were everywhere. Fog was frequent and often thick. Many days the party could not set out until afternoon. Indian villages dotted the banks. Indian visits were frequent. The natives made a poor impression on Lewis and his party, except as canoeists, where their superiority over the white men was obvious and duly acknowledged. Otherwise, they were judged to be low and ill-shaped, badly clad and illy made, petty thieves and objects of suspicion. James Rhonda points out that one reason for the overwhelmingly negative view the captains and their men had of the Indians near the mouth of the river was that the natives were accustomed to hard bargaining with whites in the sea otter trade, and therefore expected to drive equally hard bargains with the hungry explorers. Clark's journal is full of complaints about the inflated prices charged for roots and fish. The captains did not look forward to wintering with or near these Indians. They recalled with nostalgia the winter with the Mandans. They would have gladly traded the rainy weather for the bitter cold of Fort Mandan, especially if they could also have the honest and friendly Mandans for their winter companions and buffalo to eat. But it was not to be, and they determined to make the best of their situation. Their immediate concern was getting to the ocean. Not until that was accomplished could they begin to decide where to spend the winter. On November 2nd, the expedition passed the mouth of Sandy River, which had been the highest point upriver reached by European or American explorers. Lieutenant William Broughton of George Vancouver's 1792 expedition had gone this far up the Columbia. The following day, it reached present Vancouver, Washington, and camped opposite the mouth of the Willamette River, although they did not know it since the mouth was hidden by an island and they were on the north bank. For the first time since April 1805, the expedition was in country previously explored and mapped by whites. Here, the maps from west and from east came together. The party camped on an island. Lewis borrowed a small canoe from local Indians and with four men took her to a lake on the island, where they enjoyed an after-dark hunt. The lake was teeming with swans, brants, geese, and ducks. Lewis's party killed three swans, eight brants, and five ducks. On the night of November 4th, several canoe loads of Indians from the village upstream came down for a visit. They were colorful, with scarlet and blue blankets, sailors' jackets, shirts, and hats, and apparently friendly. But they also brought along a show of weaponry that included war axes, spears, bows at the ready, quivers of arrows at their sides, some muskets and pistols. It was a situation fraught with danger. Two groups of armed young men from different cultures, unable to communicate with words, facing each other. The captains were up to the challenge. "Even though those fellows we found assuming and disagreeable," Clark wrote, "we smoked with them and treated them with every attention and friendship." But the atmosphere changed when Clark discovered that one of those fellows had stole my pipe tomahawk which they were smoking with. Though Clark searched every man in the Indians' canoes, he could not find his pipe. To add to the injury, while the search was being carried out, an Indian stole Driard's capote, a long blanket coat, hooded, made of heavy wool, long popular in the Canadian fur trade. More angry words, and another search. The capote was found, but not the pipe. The captain showed their contempt and outrage, or as Clark so nicely put it, "We became much displeased with those fellows, which they discovered and moved off." At this time, the expedition was making better than 30 miles a day down the lower Columbia. On November 5th, it met the first coastal canoes, a flotilla of four of different sizes. The largest had a bear's image carved into the bow and a man's image on the stern. The design so impressed Clark that he did a sketch of the craft. On the 6th, another flotilla came out from a village, bringing roots, trout, and furs for sale at bargain prices. Clark bought two beaver skins for five small fishhooks. The Indian said there was a white man living below with whom they traded. Encouraging news and a good day. But that night, the campground was scarcely sufficient. The men had to move large stones to make a place among the smaller stones where they could lie down on the level. All was wet and disagreeable. In the morning, fog. As it slowly lifted, the expedition set off. By mid-afternoon, the sky was clear. A shout went up. In his field notes, William Clark scribbled his immortal line, "Ocean in view! Oh, the joy!" The men dug in, putting everything they had into the race to the ocean. The canoes sped along. They made 34 miles that day. Once again, the campsite was barely sufficient to lie on and composed of small stones. It was raining. Despite the conditions, Clark wrote, "Great joy in camp. We are in view of the ocean, this great Pacific Ocean which we've been so long anxious to see." They could distinctly hear waves breaking on rocks. Without comment, but there must have been some pride in it, Clark added up the miles since the first falls, Solillo, 190 miles upriver. Then he wrote, "Ocean 4,142 miles from the mouth of Missouri River." There was no celebration. It was raining too hard for Crusot to bring out his violin. But in their ragged, all but rotten clothes and under their good-for-nothing covers, each man's heart must have been warm with satisfaction, each man's mind soaring with a sense of triumph. One longs for Lewis's emotional reaction to the triumph of crossing the continent. He had been at it for 2.5 years, ever since he left Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1803. One supposes that he shared that great joy in camp that Clark wrote of, but he never expressed it himself. He had not written in his journal since meeting the Nez Perce in September, and with minor exceptions, would not again until the new year. For the biographer, Lewis's silence is a frustrating and tantalizing mystery. It was not that he didn't have time, for example. Every day he saw Clark writing in his journal, yet he did not lift his quill. Except for his severe illness when he first met the Nez Perce, Lewis had been active, coping successfully with the various challenges the party had to face. There is no hint in Clark's journal, or in the journals of the enlisted men, that he was depressed, downcast, muttering to himself, or otherwise showing symptoms of the melancholia Jefferson had observed in Lewis's father, and in Lewis when they lived together in the president's house. He was in a world filled with people, bays, weather, flora, and fauna all new to him, a situation that usually sent his quill flying over the pages, but he did not write. Was he depressed? Not so depressed as to neglect his duties, but enough to keep him from taking quill in hand to set down the day's events? If so, what caused the depression? With manic depressives, there is no agreement as to the cause of the disorder, whether biological or psychological, or what triggers either a manic or a depressed state. In many, if not most cases, a wave of euphoria, a surge of energy, and a feeling that I can do anything just comes on, followed by a wave of nausea, a draining of energy, and a feeling that I can't do anything. How long each state lasts depends on the individual, weeks, months, years. In many cases, patients in a depressed state are almost incapable of acting. They have no energy, no sense of self-worth. They feel that nothing they do will matter to anyone. Lewis would come to such a point, but he certainly didn't feel that way in the fall of 1805. He knew the importance of what he was doing, and he had the willpower to summon up the energy to operate at peak efficiency. Jefferson later commented that he thought Lewis's voyage helped him ward off depression. There is nothing like daily decision-making to get the brain functioning and the body moving. From personal experience, Jefferson knew what he was talking about. But writing was another matter. Lewis couldn't summon the energy to be reflective. Of course, he had some real problems, of which the most distasteful was having to inform Jefferson that there was no all-water route or anything remotely like it across the continent, a fact reinforced by those terrible falls on the Columbia. Did the prospect of having to cross the Bitterroots again weigh on his mind? His worries were many. He feared that the expedition would not be able to rely on its rifles for subsistence until it got back to the Great Plains and the buffalo herds. He feared that the dwindling supply of trade goods was insufficient to purchase provisions in the quantity needed. Despite having reached the ocean, the expedition would not be a success unless and until the captains got their journals back to civilization. Was the triumph of reaching the ocean only a reminder of how much remained to be done and how little he had to do it with? Did he doubt that it could be done? It cannot be that he was simply too tired. He had too often demonstrated an ability to forget his aching muscles and his nearly overwhelming need to sleep in order to describe the day's activities and discoveries. It cannot be that he felt he had nothing to say beyond what Clark had written, for he often went on side explorations and saw what Clark did not. It cannot be that he regarded his journal as unimportant. He took too good care of it at all times for that to be the case. Yet he was a professional soldier, ignoring direct orders from his commander-in-chief. There must be an explanation, but we can only guess. My guess is that he was a manic depressive. The disorder ran in his family. If this is true, then it was his special triumph that he seldom let his emotional state take over, and then only momentarily. Whether he was high or low, his emotional state played no role in daily decision-making for 2.5 years. Whatever Lewis's emotional state, it was strongly affected by his drinking habits. It had been a long time since Meriwether Lewis had had a drink, and the certainty was that it would be a long time before he had another. He had been a hard-drinking youth. In St. Louis, during the winter of 1803-4, he attended a good many balls and private parties, where it seems likely he indulged in pretty heavy drinking. It went with the territory. Frontier officers and traders drank a lot of whiskey. For the first year of the expedition, Lewis had limited himself to the same ration of whiskey the men received, hardly enough to sustain a serious alcoholic, but enough to keep a habit, perhaps even a need, alive. On July 5, 1805, he had been forced to quit cold turkey. No one can say what, if any, effect Lewis's abstinence had on his mood. Whatever the reason, the scene that so moved Clark